The following is an excerpt from the Science Podcast. To hear the whole show, visit www.sciencemag.org and click on Science Podcast.
Finally today, David Grimm, editor for our daily news site, is here to talk about some recent stories. I'm Sarah Crespi. First up, we have a story on parasite sexual mind control. Parasites can do more than hurt the health of their hosts. They have been shown to actually exert control over the host's actions. And in this case, we're going to get really specific about what a parasite can make happen and what they can't.
Right. And just to give a specific example, there's actually a parasite, there's a fungus parasite that infects ants that actually turns them into zombies. It forces the ants to actually change their behavior. They start climbing up the stems of plants, and then they actually die up there, and these spores sort of sprout from their head. It's all kind of disgusting. We've got a picture of it on the site if you want to see it. So we do know, as you mentioned, Sarah, that parasites can take over the mind of the host. The real question with this study is, there are also sexually transmitted parasites, and you would imagine sexually transmitted parasites would want to make their hosts have sex more to increase their transmission rates. But scientists don't really see this in nature, and the question is why.
So this is not something that's been studied in the wild. What did the researchers do to see whether it was even a viable idea?
Well, they created a mathematical model, and they invented two strains of a hypothetical parasite. One that was an ancestor strain that did not make its host have sex more, and a mutant that did. And they ran a simulation. They introduced both of these strains into a host, at least mathematically, and they ran it a number of times. And what they did was, if a mutant was doing well, they replaced it with a mutant that exerted more and more power over the sex life of its host. And what they found after they did this a number of times was that mutants did not evolve to make their host have more sex.
So even in this controlled environment where you're just trying to see if this conveys any advantage, they didn't have much success?
That's right. These mutant parasites just tended to burn out and die. And the researchers think it's because it's maybe actually a bad idea to make your host have sex more. And there are a number of reasons for this. One of them is if your host is so focused on sex, your host may not be eating, breathing, doing some other things it needs to do. And if your host dies, you die. Also, it actually may take a lot of energy for the parasites to exert this kind of control on their host. And it may just take so much energy that they actually ended up burning themselves out. So all of this, even though it's a mathematical model, may explain why we really don't see this very much in nature.
So if we don't see this in nature and it doesn't work in simulated environments, what can we learn from this study?
Well, scientists are still interested in sexually transmitted diseases and sexually transmitted parasites. So this may give us some more insight into how these parasites are transmitted, even if they aren't taking over the minds of their hosts.
Next up, we have a story on the loss of large mammals from the North American continent. Up until 11,000 years ago, this continent was covered in giant mammals, mammoths, ground sloths, those giant versions of sloths. But sadly, today, we can't go into the woods and see a giant beaver. At one point, though, everyone thought that the recently arrived humans hunted and ate all these so-called megafauna. Why is this hypothesis under fire, Dave?
It's actually been under fire for a while. It was proposed about 40 years ago and was called the overkill hypothesis, this idea that Paleo-Indians, which were the first Americans, when they moved into the continent, they wiped out all these very large mammals. But scientists have sort of been poking holes in this idea for a long time. They've suggested that maybe it wasn't humans, maybe it was climate change, maybe it was some other factors. There really hasn't been a lot of evidence one way or the other, and that's where this new study comes in.
And so if climate or environmental change were the root of these extinctions, what kind of new evidence could be used to maybe seal that deal?
Well, the real trick here is figuring out the time frame, because we know humans arrive in the continent about 12,700 years ago. What we don't know exactly is when these what we call megafauna started dying out. It was somewhere around that time. We don't know for sure. And so what this new study did was really focus on radiocarbon dating. And it also looked at a part of North America that really hadn't been studied a lot before, sort of the northeastern part of North America, a place that encompasses today states like New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, and the Canadian province of Ontario.
So when they took a close look at how old some of these megafauna bones were, what did they find? Did they find that there was a big overlap between humans and giant sloths?
They didn't, actually. And what they found was that a lot of these megafauna seemed to be dying out long before, or at least a couple thousand years before humans first entered the scene, and that there wasn't a whole lot of overlap, even when humans entered the scene, between them and these giant creatures. The other thing which is interesting is that the researchers didn't see any evidence on these bones, no cut marks, no signs of butchering, things that you would attribute to humans hunting and killing these animals.
So there's a lot of evidence suggested that we humans are not to blame. Minimal overlap, not a lot of hunting. Is there any way to salvage the overkill hypothesis?
Well, it may have been overkill, but maybe not overkill by us, but by the environment instead. And what the researchers suggest is that, and in fact what we know, is that the climate got a lot colder about 12,700 years ago. There was a 1,300-year-long cold snap called the Younger Dryas, which may have actually done a lot of these animals in.
Finally, we have a story on advanced gamification. Crowdsourcing is all the rage these days. Although I have yet to give any money to a Kickstarter project, I have signed up for the online game Fold It, where people all over the world help to figure out how to fold proteins. It's a very complicated problem. A related group has made the switch from proteins to RNA and added a wet lab component. How did this come about, Dave?
Well, it came about from Fold It, and the real question here is, how does RNA fold? Which is a question that even our best supercomputers have a hard time answering. So what the researchers did for this study was they turned, as you mentioned, Sarah, to gamers. And for this study, almost 40,000 gamers. So a lot of people playing this game. What was interesting about this was a lot of these crowdsourcing campaigns, which science has utilized recently, all sort of take place virtually. And what was neat about this particular study was that a lot of what the gamers were doing was actually being translated into real labs, as you said, wet labs in the real world. So there was actually a lot of physical science being done as a result of this gaming.
So how do they actually hook up a virtual game with a wet laboratory?
Well, the first thing was that all of these tens of thousands of players didn't get through all stages of the game. In fact, the game sort of weeded them out to about 1,000 people who participated in sort of the wet lab portion of the study. And the way that they did this was their actual, some of the structures that they generated were actually fed into a machine that actually synthesized this RNA, and then the scientists were actually able to analyze the structure of this RNA to see how accurate the predictions from the gamers were.
So we keep talking about this as a study. This result was published. What was kind of the main finding of the study?
Well, what was really cool is the players came up with some new rules for how RNA folds, and they were better than the standard software that researchers currently use to model this 99% of the time. So they're really best at the computers here. And because they did such a good job, this research paper actually has, get this, 37,000 authors on it.
Wow. Okay, so what else is on the site this week, Dave?
Well, Sarah, we've got a story about a new clinical trial which may help curb peanut allergies in children. Also, a story about a modern recipe for preserving ancient Chinese scrolls. For Science Insider, we've got a story about how the U.S. Congress and the National Institutes of Health are not seeing eye to eye on science education. Also, a story about new concerns about avian flu in China. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week's Science Live is about how much access you have or should have to your own personal research data, if you participate in a clinical trial, for example. And next week's Science Live is about combining alternative and modern medicine. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. You can check out the latest news, our upcoming live chats, and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org.